Move to the second case this morning, United States v. Mitten.
Good morning. I'm George Tassif with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Peoria, Illinois, appearing for the defendant appellant, Terrescence Mitten. I've raised three issues in this appeal, but I would advise the court that I wish to devote almost all of my allotted time to arguing the first issue, challenging the validity of the search warrant in this case. The second issue, involving sufficiency of evidence, I rest on the brief. The third issue that we've raised involving the propriety of a consecutive sentence for the gun count, running consecutive to the drug count, there is a split of authority where I've acknowledged this court's decision in United States versus Easter, but we rely on a pair of decisions from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, which takes a position favorable to us. Counsel for the government has filed a 28J letter citing additional authority from the 11th Circuit on the sentencing issue. We filed a 28J letter this week advising the court of its recent ruling in United States versus Bell. That, interestingly, was argued by Mr. Cox from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Havana and my colleague, Mr. McGowan, from Peoria. Your Honors, this is an issue that we are seeing in the Central District with recurring frequency. Cases where state court search warrants give rise to the seizure of guns or drugs. Case begins in state court but adopted by federal court. And what we have in this case is a rather unusual procedural posture where the issue before this court, adjudicating this primary issue of this appeal, is whether this search warrant that was issued and executed for the search of Mr. Mitten's girlfriend's apartment, because there were two apartments here, two premises, both involving the identical affidavit of this officer. Is this warrant, which the government concedes was not founded upon probable cause, is the warrant still salvaged under the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule under United States versus Leon? We respectfully submit to this court that this ought to be the case where the Seventh Circuit says to these police officers in our district that a lot more is required for establishing probable cause than a lot of verbiage in a search warrant affidavit that doesn't do anything to establish the veracity of the confidential source, his or her basis for reliability, and his or her basis for knowing of what the source is conveying to the officer.
You're not contending that the state court judge abandoned his neutral role?
No.
Strictly, the police officer should have seen on the face of this affidavit that there just wasn't anything there.
And this is not a Franks issue where we're arguing that the officer misrepresented facts. This is a question where under Leon, is the exclusionary good faith exception applicable where the affidavit does not provide the issuing judge with a substantial basis for determining the existence of probable cause? Now, there are certain cases, just get the court's decision in the United States, for Owens versus United States, which is a 2255 case, and the Fourth Circuit case of Wilhelm that we cite. There are certain easier cases to apply when you have an anonymous tipster who gives conclusory terms that in the Wilhelm case, an anonymous tipster told the police that he saw drugs in a particular house some 2 to 3 months earlier, and very little, if anything, is added to the affidavit to corroborate that. In both Wilhelm, the Fourth Circuit, and in the Owens case, this circuit said that's not going to cut it for good faith purposes. Now, since those decisions involving these anonymous tipsters, we get into that body of search warrant law where, as in this case, we have an individual known as confidential source number one or confidential source number two. And then, as is often the case, these CSs, whose true identities are not revealed, are then bootstrapped or corroborated by saying something to the effect that we have heard from other tipsters, unnamed and unknown, that the same course of conduct is being conducted by this particular defendant. So that, we're using a named CS plus unnamed CSs plus a run of a criminal history, and that's going to cut the standard.
Well, the affiant did go to see an assistant state's attorney and get a sign-off there. Isn't that right?
Yes. In this case, indeed, the record shows that the assistant state's attorney reviewed the officer's search warrant affidavit and even the initials that are on the bottom of the affidavit in the appendix are those of the assistant state's attorney. Well, as Judge Mim suggested, this is something that assistant prosecutors ought to be a little bit more vigilant and knowledgeable of as well, because the standard that we are seeking to have this court set for the validity of search warrant affidavits is not some esoteric rule that only law professors or highly experienced attorneys would understand. These rules go back to the seminal case of Illinois versus Gates in 1983.
And what troubles me is you're expecting the officer to have better judgment than the professional prosecutor.
Not at all. Not at all. Both the prosecutor and this very experienced officer whose credentials are set forth in paragraph one of his affidavit, this isn't some rookie cop we're dealing with. He has training by federal authorities, he says, in the execution of search warrants. And what we see here is that the requirement that the Supreme Court set in 1983 in the Gates case is that if you're going to rely on a confidential source, there better be information about, number one, how do we know it's truthful? Number two, how do we know it's reliable?
Well, you have two confidential informants. One
True.
Has at least one prior incident involving successful or giving information that was relied on. You have the one who basically implicates himself and says, for 3 months I sold drugs and this guy was my source. Aren't statements against penal interest, isn't there a certain indicia of reliability there? Then you also have an arrest and conviction. And you have another stop afterwards where he's basically admits to selling drugs. He has a lot of money on him. Now, the timing of these, you could argue some of it's stale. There's no timing given for one of the confidential informants, but it does seem to be in the course of this investigation. And, of course, the very nature of drug dealing is that it's an ongoing criminal activity. That's not nothing.
But, Your Honor, we have two separate premises here. So what probable cause basis do we have as to the girlfriend's apartment, H4, as opposed to the mother's home where there was a trash hit, mm-hmm. and they found drugs in one of the trash cans? And I respectfully submit far more information, as the district court found, that would establish probable cause as to mom's house. But to answer your question with respect to the criminal history of Mr. Mitten, mm-hmm. paragraph 10 of the affidavit says that Mr. Mitten had three involvements with drug possession, whatever that means, and that his criminal history any conviction.
But you're separating each one. You have to look at it in totality.
We look to each one to see if in the totality it adds up to a fair probability. So no conviction, paragraph 10, for convictions for drugs, number one.
He was on probation. Didn't he plead, and wasn't there a conviction?
I believe paragraph 10, and I'm corrected if I'm wrong, paragraph 10 of the affidavit on page 15 or 16 of our appendix reveals the extent of Mr. Mitten's criminal history. And I recall reading that this morning that it said no convictions for controlled substance, but prior involvements in as many as three such cases. Now, what happened, I'm sorry, Your Honor, because if we go to paragraph 9, that's the traffic stop. The traffic mm-hmm. stop of May 29th, a month or so before the search. Paragraph 9 of the affidavit that involved the traffic stop, they found 3.8 grams of marijuana and $13,000 in cash on Mr. Mitten. which he pled to. Mm-hmm. So I stand corrected. I stand corrected. Mm-hmm. But the criminal history information in paragraph 10 said prior involvements, no convictions. With respect to CS1, CS2, well, CS2 purchased a distribution quantity of crack at age 14 apartment. As Judge Mim remarked, what does that mean? What quantity were you talking about? It was sometime in May 2008. The search occurred in July of 2008. The other suspect, Mr. White, was present at the apartment during this unspecified drug purchase. And that CS2, according to Officer Connolly, had provided information in the past that led to at least one arrest. It doesn't even describe him as providing reliable information. And as Judge Mim remarked, what arrest are we talking about? A drug case? A jaywalking case? A trespass case? This would lead no magistrate to know how reliable this person should be.
Well, a judge is able to infer in context and from what's said. And would it be an unreasonable inference to say that an informant in this context, when he says provided information that led to an arrest, is talking about a drug case? And the state or the government isn't arguing that this is probable cause. The question is it so deficient that an officer should have known that after somebody else signs off on it, a prosecutor signs off on it, and the judge signs it, that it's invalid?
I believe that it is, and this is why. Is it too much to ask an experienced police officer to explain the specific factual basis for his belief that there's probable cause so that there can then be a judicial determination and an objective determination? We don't know, and that's why this issue is so prevalent in our community. Police, prosecutors, and even some state court judges, respectfully, are sloppy about this requirement and are reading between the lines as to things that aren't there in the four corners of the affidavit.
Why do we put it on the shoulders of the police officer when we have the trained state's attorney and judge or magistrate to make that determination?
Because that police officer is the one who's in the field acquiring the data, and he...
But if they're deficient, then they shouldn't sign the warrant.
Well, he, if anyone, ought to know what facts are giving rise during the course of the investigation, Your Honor, and that's why it's inexcusable for him not to include those facts and data to the judicial officer.
Well, it's not that he lied, then, is it?
No, no. So inexcusable, I would suggest... Okay, that's too harsh a term. But it's inexplicable. Why an experienced officer wouldn't do that. And again...
And I appreciate what you're saying about you're seeing this happening, but you haven't made out a case in this record that this officer had a pattern of going to this ADA and to this judge or using these same CSs and other affidavits.
Nothing
so
in the record that I...
You're going just on the face of this particular affidavit.
Face of this affidavit, yes. Now, the Bell case dealt with an individual... a CS that they called Rob Hale. And I would respectfully submit that Rob Hale's affidavit speaks volumes about the probable cause basis, far more than any one of these two CSs here. And yet this court found that wasn't probable cause because...
Did find good faith.
Found good faith because, as I understand and read the Bell decision, this court's earlier decisions about to what extent corroboration is necessary was really undecided. But I respectfully submit with Gates, with Kurth, with Peck, with all of these decisions, Matikyuk, we know the parameters of the Fourth Amendment law that applies here.
So Bell was wrongly decided.
Well, I respectfully submit that Bell, the volume of data from the unknown CSs, is what saved the day for Bell's search warrant. Because the known CS, Rob Hale, buttressed by numerous accounts of rumors. And I hasten to add, I have the opinion. I quote, sometime later, an informant referred to as Rob Hale told the inspector he had just left Bell's residence and then reported the detail. So the officer then takes that to the judge and gets a warrant issued within a day or two, I read, of when that information was reported. This is some kind of historical account of suspicious behavior that the officer is attempting to build inference upon inference upon inference on.
More than suspicious. There are criminal behaviors here admitted to.
Yes. There are some paragraphs that would admit that. But then the timeliness of that, the nature of the activity, and the nexus that would have to the premises that were actually searched on July 1st. Good faith, a substantial basis. I respectfully submit there is no substantial basis to save this warrant in this case, and I respectfully ask this court to reverse.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. First off, let me just, I'd like to, if I could, clear up the factual issue about Mr. Mittens, whether he had a conviction or not. And in paragraph 3 of the affidavit, it specifically refers to the traffic stop that occurred in November of 2007 when Mr. White, his criminal associate, and Mr. Mitten were in the same automobile, and at the time of the traffic stop, police officers found small quantities of powder cocaine, crack cocaine, and marijuana. And as a result of that, Mr. Mitten took responsibility for the drugs that were found in the car, and it doesn't indicate what he was convicted of. It says he was subsequently placed on probation. So as early as November of 2007, Mr. Mitten had a probation or had a conviction in connection with some of those drugs that were found in the car, and in fact was on probation at the time then that the search warrant was issued.
And wasn't there a discovery of some baggies that one of the two of them admitted were to be used for marijuana?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a second traffic stop in May of 2008. Again, Mr. White, his criminal associate,
same
Mr. Mitten. Same two guys. This time there was a small amount of marijuana found in the car. Again, Mr. Mitten claimed responsibility for the marijuana and, in fact, admitted during a later interview following that traffic stop that, in fact, he sold marijuana. So the police officers...
Were they in a vehicle that was associated with the searched address here?
This was the vehicle, the tan Buick Park Avenue, that the CS1 told Officer Connolly, the drug dealer that he purchased drugs from in apartment H14, who he identified by photograph as Mr. Mitten, he knew drove a tan Buick Park Avenue.
And wasn't it titled to the woman who lived there?
No, that was a different automobile titled to Crystal Phillips. This one, I believe, was titled to Mr. Mitten. This was Mr. Mitten's automobile. There are three different automobiles referred to in the affidavit. Two separate traffic stops, the first one in November of 2007 when Mr. Mitten received his conviction for the drugs that were found in there. Another traffic stop then in May of 2008. As everything starts coming together in May and June of 2008 in Officer Connolly's mind.
So you're getting a fair amount of information that Mr. Mitten is dealing drugs.
That's
but
correct.
Counsel raises the question, but what ties it to this house, to his girlfriend's house?
And
they do garbage checks the other place. You have this unspecified affidavit. The guy says I was in the house for 3 months or over a period selling drugs, but he doesn't say when it was. What do we have there?
Your Honor, I mean, you hit on all the shortcomings that are in the affidavit, and we are not challenged or not contesting Judge Mims' decision that this affidavit didn't have probable cause. But the question is, did the officer have some belief that there was drugs to be found in H14? He had one confidential informant who says, I have been selling. You're right. We don't know precisely the dates that he's saying. But we know that the affidavit is prepared in June of 2008, and the verb that's used is, I have been selling. I mean, the CS has been selling, which to me means ongoing activity, at least a reasonable inference, occurring as of the date of the affidavit. So let's assume that it was in those preceding 30 days. He says, I purchased all of the crack cocaine that I am in turn selling from this drug dealer in apartment H14 at these particular units in Rock Island, Illinois. The police officer shows him a photograph of Mr. Mitten. He says, that's the guy I've been buying from that location. Then we have a separate, totally separate confidential informant who, again, says, I've been dealing drugs for 10 years, says I'm buying distribution amounts. Now, we don't know the precise amount, but obviously what he's saying is, I'm a drug dealer. Again, statement against penal interest. I bought it from a woman named Crystal in the H building of these same complex. We know that Mr. Mitten's girlfriend, Crystal Phillips, lives in apartment H14. We know that Mr. White, he identifies Mr. White as being present at the time that he purchased from Crystal. We know on two previous occasions in automobile stops that Mr. White has been in the same automobile as Mr. Mitten. So all of these factors to me suggest that the police officer certainly had a good basis, maybe not sufficient, but a good basis to believe that drugs and evidence of drug dealing would be found in that specific apartment. So I don't think that he acted in bad faith. And I guess what it seems to me in this case, again, that what Mr. Tassif is doing is trying to conflate the probable cause analysis with the good faith analysis. And we're not saying that the affidavit had probable cause. But we are saying what the police officer did here is precisely what this court has encouraged police officers to do. They engage in a long-term investigation. They put together in an affidavit the information that they have. There's no suggestion that there are omissions. There's no suggestion that there are falsity in the affidavit. He doesn't just run to the state court judge and say, here, hoping the judge will sign it because the judge is hurried or distracted or whatever so that he can somehow nefariously get into this apartment. No. He takes the work that he puts together in this long affidavit to an assistant state's attorney, another trained lawyer. Now, whether the state's attorney did a good job or a bad job, in my view, is neither here nor there in the good faith analysis. What the fact is, the officer took it to a trained lawyer and said, is there probable cause here? Should I get this warrant? Can I get this warrant? And the assistant state's attorney signs off on it, agrees with it, goes then to a circuit court judge. No suggestion that the judge is in the pocket of the police officer or is somehow giving up any suggestion that the police, he's not acting in any judicial capacity. He examines the warrant. He authorizes the search. The police officer does it. To hold the police officer under those circumstances is somehow engaging in bad faith, which is really what it is, seems to me it's just absolutely not supported on this record. The court has no further questions, then I would yield back the balance of my time.
Well, the bigger problem that counsel's addressing seems to be that this is this case, and then there's the Bell case, and then there's all these other. This occurs all over the place all the time, and there doesn't seem to be any incentive to really do the warrants correctly if you keep on just saying good faith, good faith, good faith.
Your Honor,
is there any way to address that problem? Is there any way to improve law enforcement under these circumstances, or is that just the price we pay for the good faith exception?
Well, I think to some extent that is the price we pay. But again, what we're talking about are police officers who do go to judicial officers. So I mean, if there's, I don't mean this with any disrespect to the judiciary, but if the buck stops with the judge. The police officer comes in, and unless the police officer, it seems to me, is pulling the wool over the judge's eyes, or if the judge is not acting in an uninterested capacity, that the real, if you want to know where to stop it, is that I guess it would be we need to train judges better. Yeah. We need to give, I mean,
and
to lay it off on the police officer.
That's a different exception to the good faith exception. If it's, and counsel isn't arguing that the judge failed here, he's arguing that the police officer's conduct is what removes it from good faith.
I understand that, but I guess if you go back to the concept of good faith, what we say as a general matter is that there's for the social good, we don't punish society because the constable erred. And then here, again, I think that's a reasonable position for the law to take because we're not, at least on the record in this case, and the record I'm seeing with police officers that I deal with, we're not seeing people who are nefariously going to state court judges and getting warrants they don't think they should get. They may not be correct that it may be correct they don't have sufficient information and the judge shouldn't have issued the warrant when it's reviewed a year later or whatever by a separate judge. But to hold the police officer accountable for that bad decision or that wrong decision, it seems to me, is not what the law is, not what society asks, and certainly not what is constitutionally required.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How much time?
Probable cause requirement of the Fourth Amendment, which the Founding Fathers considered to be hallmark, the benchmark of the Fourth Amendment protection of privacy, is being subsumed by a good faith exception where the officer doesn't have to do his job. If the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct, then this is the kind of case where the court should put its foot down and say the constitutional rights matter. In the first paragraph of that affidavit, Mr. Mitten even tells the police about that November of 07 matter, Bright White and I live at Mom's house. And again, we have nothing linking the apartment H14 other than these two CSs which I liken to nothing more than the case of Owens and Wilhelm, where the court said no good faith. So respectfully, we ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case was taken under advisement.